This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, we do it every day. We will do it every day between now and November of 2020. It is the words of Colonel Vindman in the fall of 2019 when he was testifying during the impeachment hearing. You may be bored of it. You can't be bored of it. You may know it by heart. Of course you do. You've been hearing it now for weeks. But as he assured his father, it would be all right. What we have known is nothing is all right as long as Donald Trump is president of the United States. We are in danger. The world is in danger. The question is, what will happen in November? Now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, we love him. What can I tell you? Every time I go to Slate.com, the first place I go and look and go, so what did Mark write? What did Mark write? And of course, there is a new thing you're doing, Mark Joseph Stern, who writes at Slate.com. He writes about the courts. He writes about the law. But this sounds interesting. So I reached out to you because I am a fanatic about this issue anyway, so it's an excuse to sort of talk about it. And you wrote, can you put these gerrymandered states back together? And you are now creating these puzzles. So you'll have to explain to me, what the hell are these puzzles? And how do I engage in them? But more importantly, this is really about dreaming what could possibly happen after the next census, because that's when everything changes. You'll see a number of new congressional districts being awarded to different states because their numbers have increased. Texas is a perfect example of that. But you will also see that at the state level, the balance of power could change enormously. So talk to me about what Slate.com is doing and about this concept of gerrymandering.
Yeah, so, you know, we had a lot of fun finding some of the most gerrymandered states and working with an interactives editor to create these puzzles where you get to drag each congressional district into the state and try to figure out where in the world it is located. I will warn you, it is a challenge because, of course, many of these states, the districts are drawn in the most ridiculous, grotesque manner you can imagine. A federal judge described one of them as looking like a bat lying on the ground with its wings spread out. Some of the other ones look like a snake that somebody took a shovel to and left out in the sun. I mean, you know, these districts look disgusting, and that's because they were not drawn to ensure that any kind of community could elect their preferred representative. They were not drawn to ensure competitive elections. They were drawn to entrench one party's power. That was the goal, and that was the effect. And so we wanted people to be able to have a little bit of fun with these, to see how quickly you can put the pieces back together, but also hopefully while you're doing so, think not just about how awful it is that we have these districts today, but how terrible it's going to be over the next decade if Republicans retain their control over many state houses and are able to draw even worse gerrymanders voters in 2021, because this is the redistricting cycle. And I like to tell people the 2020 election isn't just about 2020. It isn't about 2022. It isn't about 2024. It's about a decade of power, because this is when we elect the people who are going to draw the districts that apply for the next decade. And in 2010, Democrats dropped the ball badly. And if they drop the ball again, I don't really see how Republicans can ever be shaken out of power, because they are getting really good at this and they're only getting better.
I told you just before you came on the air that there are always certain things I grab onto. And the two words that I adore that sort of describe the abortion now called gerrymandering is called packing and cracking. So give my audience a sense of how sophisticated the Republicans got in 2010, because what they were able to do in the last census was refine the art of carve out, of carve in, of creating these things that they call districts that in no way, shape, or form would even relate to a district. But what they were able to do, because they got so sophisticated, is they could practically divide bedrooms up. If the wife was a Democrat and the husband was a Republican, they might have wanted to actually sort of divide the district between the bed. But talk to us about this packing and cracking.
Oh, yeah. So this is the sort of chief tool of a gerrymanderer. And what you do is you take a bunch of data that you have purchased from these Republican firms that specialize in gerrymandering, and you can look at the racial breakdown and partisan breakdown of every single neighborhood, of every single block, of every household in the state. And what you want to do, say you're a Republican in a state like North Carolina, what you want to do is you want to pack as many Democrats into as few districts as possible, right? So you want to create these safe blue districts. You got to make a sacrifice at the beginning. So you create maybe one or two districts that just captures all of the Democrats. Think about hungry, hungry hippos. You're trying to eat up all those little balls, right? That's what you're doing with these districts. They're called blue sinks, like a sinkhole. And then you have a few Democratic neighborhoods left over that you couldn't push into those few districts. You crack them throughout the rest of the state. So you create a bunch of deep red Republican districts that are guaranteed to go to the GOP. And yes, there are some Democrats in those districts, but there's no chance in eternity that they could all get together and elect a Democrat, because they've been cracked up. That is how gerrymandering works. It is a time-honored tradition. But in 2010, with this very sophisticated technology and a lot more computing power than they had back in 1812, these guys were able to divide up these districts with such specificity that there was one in Pennsylvania that it was basically two large chunks of Republican areas that were connected by, and I'm not making this up, a single seafood restaurant off the interstate. So basically, to make it look like it was one district, they connected it through this tiny little, I don't know, 30, 40 yards wide little corridor so that they could keep this a safe red district. And, you know, you look at them now, one of the classic tricks on the state level is looking for country club neighborhoods. So what you want to do is you want to group country club neighborhoods with black neighborhoods. You want to make sure you have more country club members than black people in the district. So the black people can go and vote for Democrats, but that's not really going to matter, because there are more country club members who will outweigh them and dilute their votes. This is how it works. And frankly, moving forward, especially, I don't think lawmakers are going to be subtle about it. I don't think a lot of these guys are even going to pretend they're doing anything other than gerrymandering, because now the U.S. Supreme Court has said that federal courts can't strike down these maps. And so it's really going to be a brave new world this next redistricting cycle.
If I recall correctly, and I think it was an article that you had written, and it was referring to the decision by the North Carolina Supreme Court versus the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the North Carolina Supreme Court, which happens to be a fairly liberal court compared to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court said they could not do this, that somehow they were not capable of doing this. And then the North Carolina Supreme Court said, watch us, okay? And they basically almost put their middle fingers up in stereo, and they literally walked through exactly how it can be done and shown how unconstitutional it was under the North Carolina Constitution. But that's the part that just so breaks my heart, because in the end, just visually, it looks wrong. I mean, you don't even need to be sophisticated. You don't even need to crack and prack and whatever they're doing, packing and cracking. You just need to look at it and you know this can't be a district. And why do they not take judicial notice of what they are visually being shown to say, this isn't about connection. This isn't about relationship. This isn't a community of ideas. These people don't shop in the same place. They don't go to the same schools. There is nothing holding them together except for one partisan raison d'etre.
Right. Or depending on the state, it could be race too, right?
Right.
You know,
oh,
just
yeah,
pack
of course,
all the black, because race and partisanship are correlated.
Right.
I mean, reading the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on gerrymandering, it really felt like it boiled down to see no evil, hear no evil. You have the conservatives pretending as if it's so incredibly difficult to identify an extreme partisan gerrymander and to order a fix to it. And then you have these other courts, and Justice Elena Kagan said this in her dissent. She said, the majority says it can't be done, but it has been done over and over again, because we've already seen lower courts and state courts implement these fixes like we saw in North Carolina. And look, maybe there's no perfect map out there, but it's pretty easy to see when a gerrymander goes too far. As Justice Kagan said, how far is too far? This is too far. Look at this map. What kind of rational human being could not realize that this is an absurd violation of any sense of representation in this country in a real democracy? This isn't representation. This is rigging elections by drawing district lines.
But it's so much worse than that. You know, someday I'm going to get a theater group together, and I'm going to have the theater group read in an annotated, excited way the North Carolina Supreme Court, and then the decision and the minority report in the U.S. Supreme Court. I want people to hear this. I want people to hear it, because they need to hear, because they'll roll their eyes. Yeah. They'll be so appalled that they literally, this U.S. Supreme Court had to turn itself inside out to come up with this pablum as a justification for keeping these things. And as Kagan said, how could you? This is so absurd. And yet I want to talk about this, because in a lot of ways, your next piece that you wrote was a piece that was entitled, though I just want to get to grab it, The Supreme Court's Decision Striking Down Split Jury Verdicts is Weirder Than It Looks. Now, I want to connect this to gerrymandering. And the reason I want to connect this to gerrymandering is that gerrymandering has made partisan politics just so extreme. Mm-hmm. There is no ability for consensus. There is no reason for moderation, because everything happens in those primaries. And since the primaries are about a few people showing up, and if it's a Republican district, then they're going to be rabid Republican. If it's a blue district, then they're going to be rabid liberals. But that means that instead of being able to come together and finding consensus to sort of do the kind of legislation that's needed for a state, you find out that you've got this incredibly partisan extreme. Well, that's true in Congress, and that ultimately means that what we end up having is both a Senate, as in Mitch McConnell, who's packing the court, and you've got a president like Donald Trump who has no ideology. And then what you see is the decision that you describe in your piece that's not based on sort of judicial temperament. It's based on the partisan extremes that have approved these people, that are putting people on the bench, not because they will sort of embrace wisdom, but because of exactly what you describe in your piece about the Supreme Court, because you describe everyone having this sort of incredibly different ideology. Sometimes they back into each other. They never handshake. All right. And you really see that it's such a divisive court. But that divisive court, I really believe, Mark, goes back to the kind of disgusting results we're getting from gerrymandering, because it's percolating up and rotting out the system.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, because there's no center to the Supreme Court anymore, right?
No.
And there used to be a center for many, many years. There actually was usually a coalition of maybe two or three justices. For the last few years, it was just Kennedy. Now even he's gone, of justices who were sort of attuned to what the country was interested in, where the country was willing to go, willing to make compromises on both sides, not really ideological, but a judge in the most traditional sense of the term, balancing right and wrongs, figuring out a fair solution for all parties. And we really don't have that on the court anymore. I guess the closest is probably Justice Elena Kagan. And you know, she is willing to make compromises. I think she's a great judicial role model for people who are interested in judicial restraint and minimalism, because she does try to find that center. But even then, you know, there's just no consensus on this court about almost anything. And that really bled through to this decision, which on the one hand was a very straightforward decision, right? The Supreme Court says, look, if there's a jury verdict, whether it's in state or federal court, if it's going to be a conviction, the jurors all have to agree. It has to be unanimous. No more split verdicts. That's a good decision. I think it's definitely correct. You know, this is the fact that any state still allows these split verdicts is really kind of an embarrassment. They're rooted actually in Jim Crow era, when states wanted to dilute the votes of Black people on juries, right? So yeah, there could be one or two Black people on a jury, but they wouldn't matter, because as long as 10 whites outvoted them, you know, that's the conviction. Exactly. You know, this is a terrible scheme, and I'm very glad the Supreme Court shut it down. But there are so many opinions in this decision. I mean, so you have the majority that not five justices even joined, and then you have Justice Thomas writing separately, Justice Kavanaugh writing separately, Justice Sotomayor writing separately, Justice Alito filing a dissent that Justice Kagan joins in part. And it's such a mess because everyone has to explain their own feelings. Everyone has to explain where they agree and disagree with everybody else. And it's just a melee, even when six justices agree on the bottom line. That should be an easy peasy decision. Instead, it was a total headache for anyone trying to parse it. And I totally agree that in the old days, there could have been a lot more consensus here. There could have been an attempt to just, you know, maybe you don't agree with absolutely every word of the opinion, but you're willing to sign on to it for the greater good. And instead, there's so much division boiling over in all of these decisions on the Supreme Court. And it really worries me, because I don't like to see a court this divided. And even when it's not the 5-4 decisions, liberals versus conservatives, you're still seeing these squabbles play out in the public eye. I don't think it's good for the court's image, and I don't really think it's good for the law either.
Tell me a little bit about the backstory, because you said that abortion actually is part of the problem here. And then one of the reasons why Kagan sort of agreed in part was that she was ready to use her agreement in part when they want to overrule Roe v. Wade. Like, she wanted to say, okay, so you guys are really hypocrites, because when I agreed with you, it was for this reason, and now you're throwing that concept out. And so she was almost planning ahead for how she was going to scold them. I mean, this is like unbelievable. It's a game of chess. This isn't about decision making. It's trying to figure out, you know, 4 moves ahead, what she has to do in anticipation of something she knows is going to come up, and she wants to, at least, if nothing else, shame them.
And that is classic Kagan. You know, this was a decision that was largely about precedent. When does the court reverse an old decision that it doesn't like? When does it stand by that decision, even if it thinks it was wrong? So 6 justices said it was time to overrule this older decision from the 70s that allowed these split verdicts. And then you had Justice Kagan joining Alito and Roberts, not a very typical trio there, right? Strange bedfellows. You have them saying, well, look, this precedent is actually really important. And even if it's wrong, it has been stable. It has given these states a system that they can work with. And sometimes, because we are judges and we must practice humility, we should stand by wrong opinions. We should stand by old decisions that we may not agree with, but that have provided stability in the law. And you can apply that exact reasoning to abortion rights, right? I mean, that has Roe v. Wade written all over it, because there's no doubt that all 5 conservative justices think Roe v. Wade was wrong, right? There's no doubt that 5 conservative justices don't believe in a constitutional right to abortion access. So what Kagan is trying to tell them is, look, I get that you might think this is wrong. I think that some of these older decisions are wrong too, but we have to stand by them to keep this court and to keep the law stable and above politics, and to ensure that every personnel change in the court doesn't work a sea change in the law of the land. And I think that's a compelling argument from Kagan, but unfortunately, I don't think the conservatives really care if they're hypocrites, because they've got a much broader agenda. You know, they have their knives out for Roe. And I really don't think that Kagan joining a dissent in this case that not even that many people paid attention to is going to shame Alito and Roberts into voting the right way on abortion. You know, I'd love to be proven wrong, but we will see.
I hear what you're saying about what Kagan tried to do, but then if it's a wrong decision based in bad history, based in the fact that it was Jim Crow, then why the hell would you want to embrace it? I mean, it's like the world has changed. This hasn't provided stability. It's given cover. It's creating the illusion that, you know, oh, well, we've, what was one of the deciders said? Well, no, they actually re-embraced it after we decided that, you know, Jim Crow was illegal. I mean, it was like they have to, again, contort themselves. If it's a bad decision and the result is, you know, it still sort of reinforces these old Jim Crow laws, I don't know how Kagan, I don't know why she would go there, because I don't think she gets anything out of it. I understand what you're saying about her trying to be reasonable, trying to find compromise, trying to hurt and recognize sort of the history of stare decisis and whatever. But this, ugh,
well, you know,
doesn't get you much, honey.
I agree. Sherrilyn Ifill, head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, agrees.
Okay.
You know, I think most civil libertarians agree this was a puzzling move. But, you know, I certainly don't think that Kagan voted correctly in this case. I was disappointed, okay, no doubt. But I understand what she's doing. I'm not going to step up and defend it because I don't feel like I can defend that vote on the merits. But I understand that she is positioning herself as the most principled and consistent justice. And okay, she is saying, I am not outcome driven. I am very much devoted to my judicial tools of interpretation, and I exercise humility as a judge. And so even if I don't like this practice, even if I think it's unconstitutional, I will stand by precedent.
This brings me back to when I was running for governor. I remember the gun boys came up to me and said, what will you do on guns?
Yeah.
So I said to them, I was very honest. I said, look, my top five issues back in 1992, guns were not it. My top 10, guns were not it. My state was hemorrhaging. It was the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. I said, so here's what I'm going to tell you. I said, I'm not going to lift a finger on guns. But if there is a gun control bill that comes to my desk, I said, I won't veto it. I said, so your issue ain't with me, it's with the legislature. I said, so I'm gonna show you, that's my consistency. I'm missing my word, I'm gonna be consistent. This is not my issue. There are a lot of other issues I have to deal with. I'm not gonna use my bully pulpit. I'm not gonna do anything. But sweetheart, if it comes to my desk, guess what? It ain't getting a veto, okay? So they were like blown away. Again, it was sort of my consistency.
Right.
It didn't mean that I agreed with them, because I didn't. It didn't mean that I didn't want some form of gun control, because I did. But I also recognized that that was going to be a distraction for me, and I had an agenda that I had to address, and this was not it. And so
right,
I feel in a lot of ways what Kagan is trying to do is sort of say, this is my agenda going into the future, and I'm going to use this when you decide to overturn Roe v. Wade, and I'm going to remind you, look what I did, where are you?
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. I think that's very well put.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can agree or disagree with the strategy. But again, I respect the position, because we can't think of the justices as nine politicians in robes. I mean, we can, but it will destroy the legitimacy of the court, right? And what Kagan is trying to do is say, I am not a lawmaker. I'm not a politician. You know, I have my principles. I'm sticking to them. But this, you know, unanimous juries, that's not where my heart really lies. You know, and so I'm willing to make sacrifices here in this criminal case so that I can come back in cases about abortion or gay rights and say, you know what? I was consistent here, and I'm being consistent here, and you guys are all changing your tune because you're more interested in the outcome.
And she also knew it was going to end up being a six-three.
It's a costless vote.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So she got to make her point, still protect the integrity of the result,
right,
in a lot of ways, because her vote was not pivotal in any way, shape, or form.
Exactly.
And she was able to sort of be able to say, okay, five decisions from now, you remember me, because I'm going to bring this back up, and I'm going to leave it on everybody's chair, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
Mark Joseph Stern, you are a great teacher, you are a great talker, and here's a case that most people think, what's the big deal? No, there's a backstory here, and if you don't understand the backstory, you won't understand what's actually happening when future decisions come down. And I so value both your insight and your knowledge of these players, because God, I tell you, I want to be inside your brain. Anyway, Mark Joseph Stern writes for Slate.com. Two great things, gerrymandering and about the Supreme Court decision that looks weirder than you think. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. Current cast is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around.
When it comes to runoff, less is more on this current cast. Too much rain and too many people using a lot of water can overwhelm aging stormwater systems. That can cause them to overflow and dump pollution into rivers. Instead of rebuilding systems or adding bigger pipes, many cities are turning to green infrastructure to meet clean water standards. By creating green space where plants and soils can capture rainwater and runoff.
Less is being sent through the pipes, and there's a less chance for overflows.
That's Katie Rousseau of the nonprofit American Rivers. She says rain gardens, storage ponds, and permeable pavement, which treat stormwater at its source, are a real solution and cost less than fixing old systems. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
In 1984, I was hospitalized for poaching perfection. Slowly screwing my way across Europe. They had to make a correction. Broken and smoking where the infrared deer plunge in the digital snake. They make it so you can't shake hands when they make your hands shake. I know you like to line dance with everything so democratic and cool, but baby, no guidance when random rules. I know that a lot of what I say has been lifted off a man's room walls. And maybe I've crossed the wrong rivers and walked down all the wrong halls. But nothing can change the fact why it scared me so when you turned to me and said, yeah, you look like someone. Yeah, you look like someone who up and left me low. Oh yeah, you look like someone.
Lives. Now you know my middle name's
words are wrong and right. Honey, we got two lives to give.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We love Bob. And the reason we love Bob is that he spends a lot of time following the story in New York. So the world gets to hear Governor Cuomo. We get to hear Robert Hennelich. I just want to let you know, you're my Cuomo, Bob. Bob writes for the Chief Leader, Salon.com. He's at Stuck Nation. But more importantly, he's been covering sort of public sector workers and sort of the issues and the challenges for people working in New York for a number of years. And he wrote a piece at Salon.com that was entitled, "Is the Official COVID-19 Death Count Too Low?" Oh, trust me, it's too low. Funeral directors, EMS workers say yes. And then the subtitle, "We're fixated on the official data, which is bad enough, but we may be missing a bigger and more lethal picture." Welcome to the program, Bob.
Wow, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you are my Cuomo. You have to know that. You know, I laugh at everyone because I'm going, did you hear what Mario, what, not Mario, what Andrew, is it Andrew? Yeah, it is Andrew.
Yes.
I think. What Andrew said, and I'm like, yeah. Actually, Bob's been telling me this for a while now. So I feel like you're almost doing a form of catch up. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers, because to some extent, we need to be more honest with ourselves. I mean, we just heard a story that came out this week that I wasn't in California or Oregon or something that, you know, months before they thought that COVID had actually even arrived in that state, they discovered that there were two people that had died, and they probably died from COVID-19. We don't know the backstory. We don't know the current numbers. We're not doing enough testing. We're in kind of a denial. Is it better to assume someone died of a heart attack than to assume someone died of COVID-19? I suspect that the more we know about the real numbers, the better we will be prepared to not only address the problem, but be honest in how to sort of reopen in a way that is safe and won't slam the system.
Exactly. One of the problems with this is that we are using the hospital-generated numbers that our governors, and I say this, Governor Murphy and Governor Cuomo have all the best intentions, and they are in the position of really being facility managers. And what I mean by that is they're concerned about the impact of this unprecedented 21st century pandemic on the hospitals. And as a consequence, they miss the larger narrative. So if we want to get a sense of what's really happening, like an anthropologist, you need to speak to people who are funeral directors and EMT people who are dealing with the picking up the corpses that are dying, you know, that reflect the people that have passed, right, in the congregate care facilities where veterans and senior citizens live and people with, right, disabilities, in the hospitals and residences. You'll see that we reported very early on, April 6th, we were getting dispatches from Union EMTs, Local 2507 and 3621, that they were seeing this science fiction-like increase in cardiac arrests. So looking at a period of time from April 5th back several days, back last year in happier halcyon times, you'd see 50, 60 cardiac arrests with 20 to 30 fatals. What they were seeing was close to 300 cardiac arrests with well over 280 fatal heart attacks in people's homes. That's not reflected in the data point. And so if we're going to be using what the corporate news media presents every night, belly up and look at the latest death statistics, that is not giving us situational awareness about the pervasiveness of this disease, nor our progress in containing it. So we're really lost. We still don't have the coordinates, like a seller would say, about where we are in this unprecedented pandemic storm.
Let me read to the audience four sentences from your Salon.com piece, because there's another sort of insidious part of this story. You write, "George Kelder is CEO and executive director of the New Jersey State Funeral Directors Association, whose members are responsible for dealing with bodies at the hospital, the congregate care facilities, and private residents, as you said. He warns that if we rely solely on the official numbers carried on TV, your point, we may not fully appreciate the lethality of this disease and indeed may overestimate our success in combating it. But this is the part that blew my freaking mind. In a phone interview, Kelder confirmed that on April 15th, New Jersey's Office of Vital Statistics and Registry, in accordance with the CDC's National Vital Statistics System, had ordered that deaths of confirmed or suspected COVID-19 patients should no longer be reported with that disease as the immediate cause of death. Quote, the guidance available on the New Jersey's electronic death registration system website states that COVID-19 is not considered an immediate cause of death and should not be reported by the medical certifier on the first line of the section 36A of the death certificate. The association advised its members, instead, the immediate cause of death, such as acute respiratory distress syndrome, should be listed on the first line. COVID should be listed last. What the hell is going on? Why is the CDC ordering something? It looks like they're intentionally almost demanding that there be a cover-up.
This would be a good time to review succinctly the performance of the CDC and the Trump administration.
Merci beaucoup.
You notice this is the same CDC and administration that ignored the threat of COVID, then through a series of what I believe to be criminally negligent sliding guidances by telling nurses that no longer would they use just one N95 mask per encounter with a COVID-infected person, but they should carry it around with them for the week in a paper bag.
Oh, God.
And several other downgrades of basic occupational health because they were managing the inventory. The science didn't change on this. This had to do with them taking the pressure off the president from having to declare a national emergency and the War Productions Act. Why are you telling me that this same agency that helped spread the disease is now desperately trying to alter the historical record to make it appear that it's not as bad as we think? Exactly. And so by the time they're done, it will be what President Trump said, just a passing bubble in our national history.
This is a big story, Bob. This is not a little story. Those four sentences just jumped off the page at me because this really is about massaging the numbers. This is about protecting the president. This is about making more people vulnerable. And as I'm reading your story about, you know, the number of bodies and number of funerals and all these things they have to do, and I'm thinking, and they don't know, why isn't every single body that is brought to a crematorium, that is brought to a funeral director, that is brought anywhere, why aren't they all being tested? Why are we assuming that someone is just having a heart attack or someone just died in their sleep or whatever? Because in a lot of ways, the bodies tell us more than what's walking around.
Right. And that's because we are still operating in the very limited space presented by the president. Donald Trump is still, and his incompetence or malevolence or a mixture of both, is defining this event historically. So I did a story 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago at the Chief, where the detectives in New York City, the protocol, and I think it's pretty much similar around the country, the detectives are responsible to go into a home when there's been a death and document, take one picture, begin the process of inventory control, and examine it. All of the civil service titles that are involved with these corpses, I've interviewed their union leaders, and they all say the basic public health and occupational health would require the testing of these bodies. But they have us running around like a Chicken Little. And so basic science goes out the window and we manage and dance to the inventory as provided by the CDC and the president and the state's patchwork attempt to try to pull together what's required. So you're right. I mean, one of the things they've talked about is in doing the tests on the living, the problem is that you do the test and someone could come down with it later on, depending on where they are.
Exactly, exactly.
And they also worry about using the test too much because each time you do a test, you require a certain amount of PPE to do it. Well, from my standpoint, it would be very cost effective to check the bodies because you've already got your PPE on, right? You already danced to do the Lord's work. So you might as well just go one step further and then also give the family peace of mind. It's the ultimate contract tracing and contact tracing. And the fact that this isn't, that it's been in the chief leader and it is not being discussed in MSNBC, it's not being discussed in NPR, tells you all you need to know about how the corporate news media is taking this TikTok off of the official reporting on it, which in this standpoint gives us a false sense of what I refer to as the competency of government management. But that's right, boys and girls, we're managing the curve. Don't you feel better?
All right, so let me ask a question. So right now, because you keep hearing the metronome is test. That's, we need enough tests. So I'm hearing from some people we should have been testing 5 million a day, 20 million a day. We haven't even done 4 million or 5 million across the entire United States. So we know that testing is important. It's part of the reason why all these funeral directors and crematorium directors are not being given these tests. It's because they figured, but these people are dead. Why are you testing dead people? You should be testing people who are alive. But in a bizarre way, testing dead people, in a way, first of all, you know, they're not going to walk away, okay? They're not going to get the, they're not going to like contract the disease next week. You know that they're dead, that this is the end of the story. And to test them now is to give you both an accurate number and a number that will really sort of undermine or support what you're trying to do, which is to go back to work. And then you've got the crazies, Bob. You've got like the lieutenant governor of Texas who basically says, you know what? You should die for this economy.
Right.
This is a good thing. You should die. And I'm thinking, you know why he says that? Because he's white and privileged.
Right.
Because he knows who will die. Who will die will be the frontline workers. Who will die will be people of color. Who will die will be people who are poor. Who will die will be the old people that apparently he doesn't care about, because even though he's old, he's privileged old, as opposed to those people on Medicaid who are like in nursing homes and they're living off the government teeth called Medicaid because they're both Medicare and Medicaid qualified. So I almost feel in a bizarre way that one of the reasons why they don't want the real numbers, one of the reasons why they want some people to sacrifice, is that they want those people to disappear. This becomes a great cleansing. It sounds awful, but I feel like it's a form of ethnic cleansing. You know, that they want certain people not to be part of the future of America. And this is their excuse. And they're using the economy as the rationale because you recognize who are the vulnerable.
Right. And this, when you start cracking down, and the problem here is that, of course, the fixation on the hospital data doesn't give you the real picture. And when you do reporting, and I did in that piece, did call around because it was originally for Insider NJ. I called around to communities and got very good descriptions of what's happening in neighborhoods in like Orange and Essex County, which is an urban area that has a lot of undocumented people. And a minister described to me how he and his wife saw the EMTs come with their biohazard gear. Their neighbor died. Then several hours later, the police car stayed outside. The body was taken away. This way of disconnecting the facts on the ground from the narrative, the national narrative, gives a false sense of government management. So when they order people back to work, they will have created this kind of sense that we're on our way to managing it. Yeah. And it also is a way of tamping down the calls for radical action in the moment, which only a mass die-off event could motivate. And it's no accident that if you take a map of the zip codes where the highest income inequality exists and overlay your COVID data, you'll see, and you can see this little Venn diagram from space,
is
a direct connection between the level of income inequality and the level of death rate. I mean, this die-off happened as we live. So an example would be, let's look at this inequality as a pre-existing condition. We know that this didn't just happen. You know, you have to look at this and step back as if you're from another planet. This nation had 3 years of declining average life expectancy for the first time since World War I. This was a sick nation to begin with. Look at the opioid addiction. And so we ignored that and continue to hold on to this idea. It's like, oh, is healthcare an option or a choice? I don't want to give up my private healthcare. Just replay those debates and see how foolish they were. The reality is universal healthcare is the only way out of this for species survival. It's not a political economic question. It's an imperative.
Yeah. There's a place called Decaturish, and they had a letter to the editor from a public advocate and a lawyer. And I just want to read you a couple of the sentences, because as I'm reading you in Salon.com and I'm reading you at the Chief Leader, this story about, again, you see Georgia wanting to go back to work. You hear this drumbeat. You see the people that are, you know, outside the state capitals, especially the state capitals of Democratic governors, you know, basically demanding their liberty to go back to work. This guy writes, if there's no state order calling for businesses to be closed, the people who are unemployed can no longer claim that their unemployment is involuntary, even if it would be utter idiocy for them to return to work. A hairdresser or massage therapist cannot maintain social distance, but they can certainly file for relief unless the law says they can work. Quote, gyms, fitness centers, bowling alleys, body art studios, barbers, cosmetologists, heart designers, nail care artists, estheticians, and school and massage therapists. This is who they say can go back to work. And then this guy points out, you notice they didn't say banks, software firms, factories, or schools. And he goes on, it's no coincidence that the businesses on this list are staffed by relatively poor people, because that's who he wants off the unemployment rolls. And if they die, well, guess what? They're mostly Black people or Asian and poor, and an acceptable political loss for a Republican governor. The purpose of this isn't to open up these businesses. It's to get these workers off the dole. Work and die, or don't work, but you're on your own.
That's right.
Oh my God.
Work will set you free.
Work will set you, and you notice who they send to work.
Yes. And that is part of a national conversation that's happening as we look at what is essential work. And we do have Governor Cuomo talking for that and advocating the idea of having special hazard pay. And I might point out that the folks that are working that are essential have a high percentage of unionization compared to the prior workforce that had everybody walking around pre-COVID. So there's an opportunity here for unions to renegotiate the entire social contract about work. And I'm optimistic that that's going to happen.
So are we going to see that if there is this push, that it's not just about testing? Because as we know, it's the testing right now is even questionable. And then there's the question of whether you have, what's the after disease test that you get?
Right.
Whatever it is. Anyway, and I'm thinking, but why aren't we supplying everyone with the kind of protective gear that will make it possible for them to work in a safe setting? I am offended because I go to the grocery store the other day and everyone keeps saying the grocery store workers are the frontline workers now. Here I am in the grocery store, Bob, and I'm wearing a mask and I got gloves. The guy behind, there's a plastic shield, but every single person who's putting things on the shelf, not one of them is wearing a face mask. Not one of them is wearing gloves. I mean, it's almost like, do these employers think that their staff is expendable? Because they know people are so desperate for work that if they don't come in, there'll be someone else in the pipeline to replace them. And I went up to the manager and I said, what are you doing?
Good for you.
I'm like, what are you doing? Are you taking their temperature before they come in? Why don't they have a mask?
Did they have their picture at the courtesy counter?
I know, shut up. In a way, I feel like everyone is sort of left on their own, to interpret, how to behave. We keep hearing those pressers about, you know, social distancing and wearing a mask. And then I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's like a smorgasbord. If I want to wear a mask, I wear a mask. If I want to believe it, I want to believe it. And then you see places where we all have to go, like a grocery store or a pharmacy. And it depends on the inclination of the person who's running that. And I just think, again, there is no real understanding of what the consequences are if we don't behave as a community.
Right. And I think, though, in a union environment, we're seeing at least people have some leverage to push and act collectively, and that's more required than ever before.
So are we seeing that what you are reading about with your EMTs, that story, by the way, became a national story like 48 hours after you wrote it, because you were writing about the number of cardiac arrests that were happening in New York, that, you know, it used to be 70 and all of a sudden it was 200 and 300. I mean, I turned on MSNBC like 48 hours later, 24 hours later, and they were all talking about it. I guess the value of Bob Hennelly is that Bob Hennelly is talking to the guys on the street, talking to the guys who are the public sector workers, talking to the EMTs. And since the EMTs don't have a phone number to call and they don't have, you know, a Chris Hayes to call, they talk to you. And then eventually that story suddenly becomes important and everyone is recognizing it. But it kind of sort of suggests to you that the mainstream media, the corporate media, they don't look at the whole picture.
No, they don't. And I guess in a time of pandemic, the people you want to trust are your undertaker and your EMT.
Yeah, you're absolutely, absolutely right. So are we hearing from, my question is, what are they doing, for example, with the transit workers? What are they doing with the EMTs? Are they changing their behavior?
Well, I will tell you that to the credit of Sarah Feinberg, who is the interim president of New York City Transit, and to the union, there was a radical change. And the MTA, which is unusual, broke with the CDC before they changed the guidance. You may remember that initially when workers wanted to wear masks, the MTA, citing CDC guidance, said, no, healthy people shouldn't wear masks. And then when it became evident the CDC was lost or misleading us, you can pick your choice, the MTA began to distribute these masks. They still have some work to do. There's also a $500,000 death payout to the people. I mean, they've lost probably close to 70 workers, and there are many more that are seriously ill. A large part of it has to do with that the subway environment and the diesel bus garage environment was, even before COVID, a dangerous place. They probably should have been wearing masks all along.
Yeah, I hear you. So now that we know that they've done this, what are they doing, not just about protecting the folks that are on the buses and the folks that are running the subways? What are they expecting about the people that are using it? Is there now a level of expectation? I told you that, you know, my daughter in China, everybody is regulated, not just the people that drive in the bus, but before you get on a bus, before any kind of behavior, you have to have a mask. You have to have your temperature taken. There is an assumption that there are two sides to this equation. It's not just the guys that are driving buses that you have to worry about. It's the people that are getting on the bus. Is there now a standard
that's being set?
Yeah, right. Is there a standard being set so that people understand that if you're going to get on the subway, this is the behavior that we expect?
Yeah, there's also a great video that's making the rounds of a plainclothes detective actually escorting people off the bus who don't have a mask.
Okay.
So there is a social mores that is getting traction about it. One of the problems is as the weather gets warmer, it's going to be very hard to deal with social distancing. And so I was just listening and monitoring the city council president or city council speaker, Corey Johnson, talking about alternatives to opening up streets and thoroughfares. Because imagine you're going to have a spring that's going to come. And then how do you direct people in a way that they can deal with this reality of being in this, wanting to get outside in a very dense city, in a pandemic that is still really problematic? I mean, that's the thing I'm concerned about, is that we're getting, it's like the weather, looking at like a weather report, we're not getting an accurate reflection of the conditions on the ground to be able to make good choices. That's what I'm concerned about, with this underreporting and this kind of manufacturing consent around the fact of government's ability to manage the whole thing when they missed it and ignored it and made it worse for so much of this period of time.
So Bob, is there a way of allowing people in a dense urban area like New York to be able to get out and still, because of the density issue, I mean, do you do it in a way, I mean, I feel like we're getting more and more authoritarian, but in some ways maybe you have to, is that you say, okay, this time frame is for people this age, or this time frame is for people between A and F, or this time frame, so that what you've done is you at least understand that you want people to be able to embrace the change in weather, but at the same time, you can't make that be an excuse for people not to be able to social distance. And in an urban environment, being able to social distance is a challenge to start, but given this, Is there anyone who's sort of thinking outside the box?
There are right now. The big challenge that exists in New York City is how to deliver emergency services and give access to ambulances and fire engines and first responders at the same time as having as much common space as possible. And they're working that out now. And the mayor is kind of pushing back and is reluctant to do some of the more progressive policies in other cities. But the city council appears to be trying to push to force the DOT to think out of the box. This is an ongoing social experiment for which there is no precedent.
There is no precedent. That's exactly right. Well, but thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You know, and that's okay. I just want everyone to know that you watch Andrew Cuomo on TV, and I talk to Bob Hennelly on the radio.
So thank you.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Artie Artisan and Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Stick around. We'll talk to you tomorrow. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. Way on the way back when. I didn't even know you. You couldn't have been too much more than 10.